CIUT 89.5 FM, The Taylor Report. I'm Phil Taylor. Phil Conlon is here, and we're going to be speaking. Pardon me.
Hello.
Hello there. And by the way, Phil conducts an excellent program on Wednesdays at 6 o'clock, Classical Underground, often addressing issues of correlation, music and politics, and how people use music as a form of resistance. By the way, if you want to hear about music that ain't a form of resistance, there's a Toronto Star reports that in Latvia, some people who want to glorify a figure from the Nazi era have made a music about him, musical. His name is Kuchar. And it's, I hate to say this, but it's like a joke on a joke. This is, it was a wonderful film called The Producers, in which the one of the comic figures wrote a musical called Springtime for Hitler. Turns out in Latvia, they've got one. And they didn't want to debate, oh, did he actually personally kill? He was a member of a Nazi collaborating killer group. He was an officer. So actually, whether he wore a hat or a different pair of shoes really didn't have anything to do with it. That's one of the shocking things. That's why there was a UN resolution recently put forward saying glorification of Nazism should be condemned around the world. And the General Assembly voted. Three countries voted no: Ukraine, Canada, and the United States. And I don't see the Toronto Star writing editorials about it, by the way, nor the Globe and Mail. So I want to know, we had a World War II. Which side were you guys on? And a lot of people say, well, we ought to bring in other issues. Other issues? Do you know how the UN was founded? In the war against Nazism. That's how it was founded. So you're going to have a little trouble with your other issues department. But go ahead and try it. Anyhow, you're listening to Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM, and we're joined now by Toronto lawyer David Jacobs. Are you there?
I am. Hello.
David, there is big news has come from The Hague after quite a long struggle over the sitting president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta, which, by the way, there was a case made against him at the beginning of his administration. He was almost prevented from assuming office as president because he had been charged by the ICC. But now there's been a dramatic development in the case. I'll leave it to you to tell us what happened.
Well, the dramatic development is that on December the 5th, if I got the date correct, the prosecutor withdrew all charges against Uhuru Kenyatta, the president of Kenya. And the background of this, is, as you mentioned earlier, is that in relation to election violence which took place in Kenya, the prosecutor of the ICC declared as early as December of 2010 that Uhuru Kenyatta was a suspect, and he was formally indicted by the tribunal in the 8th of March 2011. I just should explain to everyone listening how this works before the international tribunals. The prosecutor will draft up an indictment and then go before the court to get the indictment confirmed, at which time it's apparently a legal indictment. The one thing the prosecutor seems to have missed at the time of getting the court to confirm the indictment was evidence. That is,
oh, evidence.
Yeah, that apparently was something that slipped the prosecutor's mind. Generally, I suppose, in our system or in any system, prosecutors proceed on the basis that they at least believe they have evidence which could prove the accused guilty. The way this appears to have worked is that the indictment came before the investigation. Anyway, by the December of 2013, the prosecution went to the court. Now, you note this is almost three years after they've declared him a suspect, and there's a trial date set for February of 2014. And the prosecution says, we don't have enough evidence. We want an adjournment. And at that time, of course, the defense says, well, if you don't have enough evidence, you have to drop the charges. That's what happens in most civilized court systems.
Yeah, in Kenya, that would, which has a system, by the way.
Yeah, so the defense does actually say in common law systems that this is what usually happens. Anyway, but they grant an adjournment request, and in March, they make a formal request for cooperation from Kenya. But all the while, by the way, the prosecution is saying that its problems are not its fault, but are the result of the defense. Specifically, it seems to be saying that Uhuru Kenyatta himself and the Kenyan government are responsible for obstruction and intimidation of witnesses, because some of the prosecution witnesses decided that they couldn't tell the stories they were originally going to tell about Kenyatta, so that pulled the rug out from the prosecution to some extent.
Well, by the way, isn't there an issue, this thing about the statements? The media here has tried to suggest, Kenyatta influenced them and et cetera. However, the defense has pointed out that pressure was coming on witnesses from the prosecution side.
Yes, and not just that.
Not from Kenyatta's side.
The defense says from the word go, it has been telling the prosecution that its witnesses were unreliable, its evidence was frail, but of course the prosecution didn't listen to any of that. So by the time we get to August of this year, August of 2014, the court again asks the prosecution, are you ready again? And the prosecution says no, and they want a further adjournment. They want an indefinite adjournment, arguing that at that time, and now look how far we are, we're now at the end of 2014, they say we have insufficient evidence, this is what they say, to prove our case beyond a reasonable doubt, so we want an indefinite adjournment.
And you're talking about the president of a country.
Yes, we're talking about the president.
An elected president.
Yeah. So, at the, about, I'm not sure the exact date, but roughly a week ago or so, actually, I'm sorry, I can tell you the exact date, on the 3rd of December, the court really gave the prosecution a week to put up or shut up, and frankly did not buy its attempt to shift blame onto the Kenyan government, or particularly onto Uhuru Kenyatta. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read a little bit from their judgment of the 3rd of December.
We'd like to hear that.
The unanimous judgment of the trial chamber of the International Criminal Court. It says, it has been submitted, saying by the prosecution, that the alleged noncompliance or obstruction on the part of the Kenyan government can be attributed to Mr. Kenyatta, and that the requested adjournment would therefore not be contrary to the rights of the accused. First, to the extent this submission is directed towards alleging that there has been deliberate interference by Mr. Kenyatta, the chamber notes that no substantiation for such an allegation has been provided. Indeed, the prosecution has conceded it has no evidence to support such an allegation.
By the way, you're a member of the bar here, and there are two. There's a Canadian member of the prosecution team, and there's a British lawyer who's a member of the prosecution team. Don't they have standards of their own that would say, look, we don't have a case, and the judge has told us we should step aside and let this thing go and go back to doing proper preparation of cases?
Well, the chamber goes further in terms of the complaint that the Kenyan government is not cooperative. The chamber said the prosecution itself had been delayed in effectively pursuing the request for cooperation from the Kenyan government, and that the delay wasn't adequately explained. And then the chamber goes on to say something which is really quite startling, it seems to me. It says it's only after the second adjournment request, which was made by the prosecutor, and after other investigative avenues proved fruitless, that the prosecution sought to make the future direction of the proceedings in this case explicitly dependent upon the Kenyan government's compliance with outstanding cooperation requests. Had the prosecution genuinely considered such compliance to be so central to establishing the charges in this case, the chamber would have expected the matter to be vigorously pursued at a much earlier stage.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me that's very damaging. But one of the things that I find disturbing looking at this, and I watched the television reports on the weekend about this from places like Al Jazeera, the BBC, is that they seem to be repeating the allegations made by the prosecution, which about the responsibility of Mr. Kenyatta for the problems and the responsibility of the Kenyan government, allegations which this court has said are unsubstantiated.
Rather important.
it's disturbing for them to continue to try to affix blame on Mr. Kenyatta.
It would be helpful. Sometimes judges in cases, I've seen them do it here in courtrooms, say the reporting of incidents in the press has been inaccurate and misstated what happened in the courtroom.
Well,
this almost calls for that. By the way, could we say it was Stephen Kay,
yes,
whom I remember from Arusha, Tanzania, who led the defense, and he made a rather strong statement, which would help us all in knowing how to react to this situation. You tell us what Stephen Kay had to say.
Maybe I could read it, yes. You can find it on a website called International Criminal Law Bureau, and it's signed by Stephen Kay, QC, and his co-counsel, Gillian Higgins, mm-hmm. both of whom work in the international criminal law area. So it's a short, but I'll read it out. The defense welcomes the withdrawal of charges against President Uhuru Muigai Kenyatta. I hope I'm pronouncing mm-hmm. his middle name correctly. The charges in this case were confirmed on the basis of false evidence. The prosecution was warned about the falsity of its evidence from the start, but these defense warnings went unheeded. Insufficient investigations and over-reliance on untested NGO reports crippled this case.
I like that line. Could you repeat that one?
Over-reliance on untested NGO reports.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, as an aside, let me say something. I'm not reading anymore from Stephen Kay, but if anyone, the decision, the ICC decision, is available on the internet, but there's a third party involved, if I can just mention it, and that's what's called the LRV, the Lawyer for the Representatives of the Victims, which that lawyer weighed in very heavily on the side of the prosecution, even bringing motions at certain stages of the proceedings to be allowed to make further submissions and so on, which really underscores for me, and this is sort of a separate proposition, really, that the concept of victims' rights and victim participation and transitional justice, which is now pretty central to international criminal law, is so unbelievably damaging, because now it's so unfair that in a criminal process you have a three-cornered fight, and one of the people is in the corner of people who are already described as victims at the outset of the case, which really is very difficult for the defense, because now you have an uphill battle to try to convince the court that A, you didn't do anything wrong, and B, the people who claim to be victims of your wrongdoing are either not victims of anybody's wrongdoing at all, or certainly not victims of your wrongdoing.
Yes.
Anyway, that's an
aside.
They
get to wear this jersey without having shown that it belongs on them.
No, I mean,
that's a problem.
That's why the whole concept of the victim being involved in a criminal process is so, frankly, obnoxious, because you've got an individual who's facing
yes.
deprivation of liberty. And
yeah. Well, we know the language is such, you know, that if someone is harmed, they're robbed, killed, they say the state versus the accused person. It's not the person who was robbed. It is the state against them for breaking the law.
There are remedies available for victims, but they're different from.
We're seeing a lot of that in actually a lot of venues where the press often prefers civil suits. They report on that as though they've proven somebody did something when they couldn't prove it in a courtroom.
Absolutely.
Now, look, I didn't mean to interrupt, though. You
had
Stephen Kay's message. I'm sorry.
I interrupted myself, and that was fine. So, insufficient investigations and over-reliance on untested NGO reports crippled this case from its inception. The prosecution failed to disclose exculpatory evidence in the confirmation of charges hearing, seriously misleading the court as to the quality of its case. So, again, that's what I was talking about, the confirmation of charges hearing, which when judges confirm the indictment. So back to the text. Having considered all matters before it, the court has found that the prosecution's failure to take appropriate steps to verify the credibility and reliability of its evidence is the, quote, direct reason for the failure of this case. It has dismissed the unsubstantiated allegations that President Kenyatta has in any way interfered with the collection of evidence or the administration of justice. There is no evidence whatsoever that Uhuru Kenyatta has been involved in the alleged intimidation of witnesses. This serious allegation has been repeatedly and irresponsibly cast by the prosecution and the victim's representative without any substantiation, and duly dismissed by the judges of the court. The chamber has instead expressed its concern at evidence that prosecution witnesses have been involved in a conspiracy to fabricate evidence for financial gain, and the prosecution witnesses had sought to intimidate defense witnesses. The prosecution was itself involved with a witness who had previously attempted to extort money from the defense in an attempt to entrap Uhuru Kenyatta. Conduct such as this betrays the prosecution's real attitude to truth and justice. Similarly, the prosecution has latterly sought to lay the blame for its deficient case with the government of Kenya. In its decision on noncompliance, the trial chamber called into question the true motives of the prosecution in pursuing a finding of noncompliance against the government of Kenya, stating that the prosecution's conduct was, quote, not reflective of a prosecutorial and investigative body effectively seeking to obtain the requested materials, close quote. The chamber continued, quote, if the primary objective of pursuing the cooperation request at this time was to actually obtain the requested materials, the chamber would have expected to see a greater degree of diligence, persistence, and where necessary, flexibility on the part of the prosecution, close quote. In its decision rejecting the prosecution's request for an indefinite adjournment, the chamber called the prosecution's conduct disingenuous. The prosecution has today released statements that contort the findings of the court and insult both the judicial process and the government of the Republic of Kenya. The proper conduct of this case is the duty of the prosecution, and it must accept responsibility for bringing international justice into disrepute. The prosecution owes President Kenyatta, the victims of the post-election violence, and the people of Kenya an explanation and an apology for failing to investigate the post-election violence properly and shielding those involved behind its witness protection scheme. Further,
wow, I like that phrase, witness protection scheme. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry. Further, the prosecution owes President Kenyatta an apology for impugning his integrity and relying on the inconsistent testimony of false witnesses. Stephen K. QC, Gillian Higgins, 5th December 2014.
That's a very important document. Is that generally available? Can people find that?
Yes. I think it's easily found on the internet. If you would look up www.internationallawbureau.com.
All right.
And
then put slash Stephen K. You probably get it, huh?
Well, no, I don't think you even need to go that far. If you look at,
I'm looking at
their homepage at the moment, and. It's there on the homepage. It says by Christy Sutherland, statement of the defense of Uhuru Muigai Kenyatta in respect of the withdrawal of charges.
Yeah. Now, this is very important. By the way, Mr. Kenyatta himself, President Kenyatta, the youngest president in Kenyan history, he's a son of Jomo Kenyatta, who is the father of modern Kenya, who led the struggle against British colonialism, in case people forgot about British colonialism. He issued a strong statement as well, and he says this was a victory for African unity, right?
Yes, correct. I don't know if your listeners will tolerate me reading the whole thing, but he certainly says that. I mean, he ends off by saying, as we promised, we have not, and shall never let the cases sully our sovereignty or get in the way of managing the affairs of our nation. He says, I thank the people of Africa and all their leaders who, through the African Union, demonstrated robust and unflinching support by word and deed in the true spirit of African brotherhood. Your solidarity has deeply touched and inspired me.
And that's a very nice statement. This is... You know the context, David, you could probably speak to this. This is such an embarrassing situation. They set up this ICC, International Criminal Court, and so far the targets have been African leaders of various types, including the president of Kenya, who ran in an open election, and it undisputed, by the way, I think international observers for the last election, and won, and he's put through this humiliating exercise.
He wrote, by the way, around the time of the, frankly, just before the prosecution was asked for its first adjournment request, just about a month before, 2 months before. He wrote the following in, in the Kenyan press, but I'm going to read this. Cynicism has no place in justice. yet it takes no mean amount of selfish and malevolent calculation to mutate a quest for accountability on the basis of truth into a hunger for dramatic sacrifices to advance geopolitical ends. The ICC has been reduced to a painfully farcical pantomime, a travesty that adds insult to the injury of victims. It has stopped being the home of justice the day it became a toy, the day it became the toy of declining imperial powers.
That's a rather clear statement. We need some point, an analysis of how this all unfolded. It was greeted by the media as such a wonderful development, and it wasn't long before suddenly we had this thing of prosecuting Africans. We had charges brought against Gaddafi when terrorists were attacking his soldiers in Libya, and he was charged with giving Viagra to his soldiers. I mean, I don't know why they didn't ask him just to shut it down at that point.
Well, by the way, that's one of the most offensive kinds of allegations, because it's got such racist overtones that it's not even funny in it.
Not at all. Now, you went to The Hague. This has been the issue with the so-called ad hoc tribunals and with the permanent one. The selectivity of the process. So you and Michael Mandel had one of those little historic moments where you met the prosecutor at that time of the Yugoslav tribunal and asked them to prosecute those who were bombing Serbia, but they were not interested in that.
No, I must say it's such a privilege to have gone along to The Hague with Michael Mandel, late Michael Mandel, to try to persuade the Carlo Del Ponte on the basis of just voluminous evidence that the NATO attack on Yugoslavia was a war crime, but also the manner in which they were attacking Yugoslavia was criminal in and of itself. They were bombing communications facilities and civilian infrastructure facilities and on and on and on, causing massive civilian deaths. And we were unable to persuade Carlo Del Ponte, who at the time was the chief prosecutor of both the Yugoslav and the Rwandan tribunals. We were unable to persuade her to lay charges against NATO. One of the, I suppose, ironies of it is that while we met with her, she was flanked by two legal advisors, one lawyer from Scotland and one from Canada, both part of NATO nations who were involved in the bombing of Yugoslavia. Although Carlo Del Ponte's book about this is quite interesting, as she appears to have been quite disturbed by the volume of evidence about NATO crimes. But
wasn't her mandate.
Wasn't a mandate, and the people investigating on behalf of the prosecutor's office simply said that they essentially believed the press releases put out by NATO, that they weren't being bad, you know.
Yes.
Michael Mandel wrote in an article, we'd have some trouble with police services who went to arrest people, and people they were arresting said, no, we didn't do anything wrong. I said, oh, yeah, we've got to rely on that.
Yeah. he told me he didn't do it, so I came back.
Yeah. Exactly right.
Well, that's one. David, thank you very much. You've clarified that, and we are very pleased that this decision is not going to hide that. And Stephen Kay deserves a lot of credit. But let's hope that this ICC finally goes off into the wilderness where it belongs. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
David Jacobs. They treated NATO the way the Attorney General treats the NYPD. They get a pass. So you're listening to Taylor Report. It's CIT 89.5 FM. I want to mention that last week on the program we pointed out that there had been two large demonstrations in Montreal and Quebec City, numbering a total of more than 200,000 people protesting against the Liberal Party of Quebec's cuts to services, particularly child care, which, as our listeners will know, Quebec has a very exemplary program for child care. And they had promised they would not do that, but then after having been elected, of course, they did it. Well, I was reading the Toronto Star. They followed our report. They didn't report on the events themselves, but they waited a few days, and then they wrote a kind of a semi-analysis report. But they added insult to injury, as far as I'm concerned, in the way they wrote about it. They of course, are very protective of Mr. Couillard, the Liberal Party man. That would be because they're a Liberal Party paper. But they said that the demonstrations had been called by union bosses. So I want to tell them, I don't know if you have a little stylist down there, a thing that guides you on use of language, but a worker in a factory who belongs to a union works for the people who employ him. That would be the boss. If Ford Motor Company, that's the boss. If they belong to a union, they have union leaders, but they're not the bosses. So you guys at the Star don't even know how to write English. And they never, by the way, say fat cats or bosses when they're talking about the bosses. Instead, they're, you know, executives, CEOs. But a union leader who's trying to protect his working families from losing this wonderful daycare system, he's called a boss, or they are called bosses. And by the way, a total misrepresentation of the facts in the case anyway is because, in fact, those demonstrations were so massive, these were not matters only left in the hands of particular unions. I think we have a piece of music we should share with you. It's Bill Brunsey, and it's the appropriate tune for Ferguson and New York City and the treatment of African Americans.
If you black and gotta work for a living now, this is what they will say to you. This is, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.